Very good. Oh, good. We've got a few questions, but not too many. So I think a couple of people coming in, so wait for that. And then the plan for this afternoon is to do the questions at about 3:30, 3:45, and then have a break, and then we do the loving kindness meditation. Finish around 4:30. Is that okay? Very good. Okay. I think all the very important people are in now. When I say that, somebody else comes in and gets offended. So anyway, here we go. Dear Ajahn, I don't know what jhana is like, but appreciating the nature around here and your teaching has already given me great joy. I ask and want no more. Thanks for everything you have done. Awesome. It's excellent, because little by little, you know, you talk about everything from the beginnings to the endings of this path and everything which comes in. It is a happy path. It gets happier and happier as you practice more and more joy, and eventually the joy just comes into these deep states of mind, and you'll be surprised that sometimes you're not expecting it, and these things just happen. And the lights in the mind, and limiters and stuff, but you don't really need to know what it is like, because eventually it just happens. And at least, that's what Ajahn Brahm meant. Next, how to deal with our loved ones' sufferings. For example, to see someone you care about is facing a serious sickness, etc. And first of all, that it's hard to face one's own sufferings in life. But if you learn from your own sufferings of what sickness really is and how to deal with your own sickness. So from time to time, if you are really sick, I don't want to be sick, I've got many things to do. But first of all, you realize that sickness is part of life. Which is one of the reasons I try not to stigmatize sickness. And I think I mentioned on one of the first talks, when you ever go to see the doctors, you should never, ever, 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 ever say to the doctor, "Doctor, there's something wrong with me. I'm sick." They're already stigmatized. There's nothing wrong with being sick. We're all sick from time to time. It's part of life. It's usual. And in case that anyone never, ever, ever, ever got sick in their whole life, you'd be such a weird case. You spend a lot of your days in hospitals when they do tests on you to try and figure out what's wrong with you that you don't get sick. The point being that it's obvious that being sick is nothing wrong. So when you see the GP, you'd always say to them, or the specialist, "Doctor, there's something right with me. I'm sick again." In other words, you take off the negativity around sickness. It's part of life. And so even by doing that much, straight away you're lessening the sting of happiness, of sickness. Because that's what the Buddha said, even though your body is sick, doesn't mean the mind is sick. And if you can, just balance your mind and be wise that sometimes you're sick, you're supposed to be sick, you're hurting, but you've got such a wonderful attitude to it, the mind is happy, which means your sickness doesn't last that long. That you all notice the power of happiness and kindness to overcome such pain. So once you learn from your own suffering, then you can actually look at someone you care about who's also facing serious sickness. And you don't add to their sickness by going, "Oh, that's terrible. Oh, I hope you get better soon." Oh, instead, you can try what all we've been doing for a long time, is when someone is really sick, like this man, he was a monk, and he was a Rhodes Scholar, and he was a monk with us, and he got, we didn't know exactly what it was at the time, but it was actually two two strains of typhoid at the same time, and he got really, really sick and very close to dying. But he was so close to dying, he pulled through, but he never really got better. And so we sent him to the monastery in England and trying to get the best treatments, all types of treatments, you know, the usual allopathy, homeopathy, radiation therapy, all the sorts of pathies, including naturopathy and psychopathy, and we didn't do psychopathy, that's psychopathic, but all types, but nothing worked. And then one day, because I went to go and see him once, and he was in the attic of the Chitos Monastery, this old house, and in the attic, if you ever read books like Jane Austen, that's where they put the crazy people, you know, up in the attic, so lock the door. And this was, a monk was up in the attic, and it was really dark, he could never really get out of bed and go to the door because he got exhausted. He was there for a couple of years, just really, really sick, and nothing was working. Best doctors, but no one knew what to do, until one day the head monk came in there and he said, I've come up here on behalf of all the monks and nuns in this monastery, on behalf of all the supporters, all the people who know you and love you and care for you, on behalf of all of those, I've come up here to give you permission to die. You don't have to try so hard to get better. It's okay to die. At which point, that monk, he's a Rhodes Scholar, he's a champion wrestler. He burst out crying, he wept, and from that day on, he got better. And he's still alive today. You know, he did disrobe, but, you know, he's still alive. He lives in South Africa. That's like 20, 30 years ago. He was trying so hard to get better, because he didn't want to disappoint the people who cared for him and put so many resources in trying to bring him to good health. He didn't want to disappoint them at all. He was trying so hard to get better, it was making him sick. If you can understand that. Now, it's your loved ones. If you're really sick, it's one of the, you see them coming into your room and they're so devastated for seeing how weak you are and how thin you are. You're not the same person as they knew before. Oh, they're just emotionally distraught to see you getting closer and closer to death. And then you see them, you're dying, and it's hard enough to deal with your own sickness and impending death. And now you have to deal with the emotional problems of your loved ones as well. And so you're trying so hard not to disappoint. People are spending so much money and so many resources trying to get you to feel better. That pressure is one of the causes of sickness. And it's happened many times since then. People are very sick and you say, it's okay, we give you permission to die. You don't mean it as a joke. You don't mean it just to get rid of them so you can inherit your inheritance. You do it really so, look, it's okay to die. It's part of our life, so don't try so hard to please us. We love you no matter what happens. You know, we'll always care for you. But it's okay to die. And when they hear that, it's a sense of great freedom. They try so hard to get better. And they feel so disappointed, to the point that when you go and see them, you always ask them, how are you feeling today? Are you feeling better? And, oh, I'm feeling a little bit better. You lie. Because you're lying there because, you know, you're telling an untruth because you don't want to disappoint your friends and loved ones. They've come such a long way, taken time off their busy schedule, taken time off work, and they go and see you, and the pressure's on you to get better, to please them, to say, oh, please get well soon. And you don't. In other words, you're disappointing the people who really care about you. That pressure, psychological pressure, is one of the reasons people stay sick. So when a person is suffering, you can go to them, just visit them is good. But for goodness sake, never ask them, how are you feeling today? Because, you know, if they're honest, they'll say, I feel terrible. That's why I'm in hospital. So instead of trying to make them live up to your expectations and get better. You just say, we love you. Tell them all of the stories which are happening in the world, what you've been up to. Always talk to people who are in hospital as if you were talking to them at a coffee shop. So you don't talk to the sickness, you talk to the person. And that's one great way of dealing with your loved one's sufferings. It really fits into that professor of schizophrenia who never treats schizophrenia in Singapore, treats the other part of the patient. So you see a person really sort of sick and suffering in your family, look at the other part of that person, which isn't suffering. There's another part to them as well. Maybe they don't see that themselves. They're so consumed with their sickness, they don't see the other part of them. So anyway, that's one way to deal with it. Dear Ajahn, one of your greatest sayings is to put down a cup or put down a glass. Often I tried it, but mostly I can't put things aside. Either I want to solve it directly or just throw it away. What to do and how to train my mind? Okay, that put down a cup, so we just take a rest for a little while. That's also part of that, part of this idea is that story which is in that first book, The Good, Bad, Who Knows, which I haven't said on this retreat so far, and that is about the British soldier in the jungles of Burma during the Second World War. I think some of you know that story, I hope, and this was told to me by the person himself. He was a young man, and when he joined up, he didn't really have much choice. Everybody had to join up during that Second World War and become a soldier or do something. And so he was sent to Burma. He wasn't a violent man, but he was just on a patrol in the jungle somewhere, and with a group of about five or six other soldiers, when the news came in that they'd wandered into a whole battalion almost, a huge number of Japanese troops. They were totally surrounded and outnumbered. Now imagine, this is war. Imagine if that was you, how scary that would be. This is it. You're not going to get out of this situation. And so this young man, and as I've heard this before, no one ever can predict who the hero will be. Even these big, tough guys who trained in the gym, when it gets to such a point that death is imminent, they just turn to jelly and they want to run. But this man, he wasn't very big, but he decided to be the hero. He said, let's fight our way out. Who knows? Maybe we can find a way through. But sitting here and doing nothing, that's certain death. And this was a long time before Bruce Willis and Die Hard started. But in real life, they'd have all been killed. So the captain knew that, so he ordered them, no, put down your guns. We will not fight our way out. And surrender was not an option. So instead, the captain ordered, you have to follow orders at war in an army. The order is you will all sit down and have a cup of tea. The British Army. Even at war they have a tea break. That's crazy. And he thought, this is ridiculous, this is stupid. This is the most mad thing he'd ever done in his whole life. In the jungles of Burma, a long way from home, at war, totally outnumbered, about to be attacked by Japanese highly trained troops. Oh, having a cup of tea, who can think of having a cup of tea, but orders were orders, and so he had to sit down and have a cup of tea, and before they finished making the tea, the scout came back and said, put things away quickly. The enemy has moved. There's a way out. And of course, they all crawled quietly, silently, through the gap in the surrounding forces, which means every one of those soldiers escaped. That was why that man told me that story when I was a young school teacher in Devon. And I thought, wow, what a brilliant story that is. When there's nothing to do in life, Don't fight and try and figure out the problems. You get killed and make the things worse. You just sit down and have a cup of tea. If you don't like tea, just have a coffee. If you don't like coffee, a peppermint juice, peppermint tea, or some orange juice, or longan juice, or anything. But just don't do anything, okay? Just sit down and relax to the max to keep your energies all ready. So when there is something to do, you pounce and you escape. And he said that, he told me that he had cancer later on in life. And again, there's nothing you could do, so he just relaxed. Nothing you can do, just take it easy. And of course, because he took it easy, relaxed, the tumours started to dissipate. Or at least they got smaller. How many times is the tightness and the tension, because we get scared, we think we have to do something. How many times is that the real killer? So, put down a cup, you know, when it's time to rest. Sit down and have a cup of tea when you're surrounded by death and disaster in all directions, there's no way out. That is a lot of wisdom. And it's not doing nothing. It's such a positive thing to do. You wait. You wait for the other person to make the mistake, the other team to make the mistake, and you're ready. And when it's time, then you can take advantage. So put down a cup or put down a glass. You tried it, but this is what happens. It's very heavy, you put it down, and before you're tired, before you recovered, you pick it up again. So it's just like those people, those soldiers, sitting down having a cup of tea, and they haven't, just, they just sip the tea, and one goes out, has the enemy moved yet? And they go and get caught, bang. So we have to, when we let it go, we really have to let it go. Put it down, and wait. The problem is, impatience. We are such an impatient people wherever we go in this world. You see that when people are just waiting to actually board their flights. Have you ever noticed on an aircraft, you're all probably going on an aircraft tomorrow, the people who get on the aircraft first are the people who want to get out of the aircraft first. And I can't imagine that. It doesn't make any sense. If you're like lining up trying to get being the first in the queue to get on the aircraft, it must mean you must like aircrafts. So you get on there first. And so, you know, why don't those people who get on first, because they like it, get off last? You know, as for me, it'd be much better to actually get on last. Get on the aircraft last. And then that means you don't spend so much time in the aircraft. It's no comment on the wonderful flight attendants which you meet on great airlines like Cathay Pacific, Zurich. But it's a comment that why is it people want to get on first and then get off first? They're just impatient. So anyway, that if you're patient, oh, just let someone else get on first. After you, sir. And be so patient. And they will say, no, after you, madam. So no, I insist, after you, sir. So no, I insist, I'm a Buddhist, and I always let other people go first, so after you, madam. And then, no, I'm a Buddhist too, so after you, sir. And that's why it takes forever to board passengers on a Buddhist airline. But anyway, that sort of, that kindness is really, really nice. So anyway, that's what happens. Patience is also something we have to learn. And who was it who asked that question about what is patience? I'll answer it on the next retreat. With the advanced technology, how about cloning Ajahn Brahm? So the clone can go on a world teaching tour and the real one can continue to meditate and do what he needs to. Best of all, you will be eternal. What is your view on this? Yes, but you won't know who is the real Ajahn Brahm and who is not the real Ajahn. How would you know? So what would happen is, you know, I want to go back in my cave and my clone's got the cave. So I don't know. and the clown misbehaves and tells wrong stories, and I'm the one who gets the blame. So, clowns do not work in being eternal. Now, honestly, do you want to hear the same old jokes 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now? The happiness you want to keep, but the material needs to be improved. I need a scriptwriter, that's what I need. Anyway, so, a nice idea. How have you helped Buddhists maintain harmony with other religions who believe in a God or Creator? I already mentioned that when you change the idea of what a God is, or a Creator is, to include people with different ideas. So you really try hard to listen to another person, and understand their language, and actually just deal with their language. What was it that a friend I had who was quite a devout Christian, and he said to me, I think I already told that story, that, you know, Ajahn Brahm, you have to admit that nothing is better than God. And I said, yeah, it's true. Nothing, emptiness, is much higher and better than any creator being. So that's really good. So nothing is emptiness. So, of course, they weren't very happy about that, but anyway. So we also have all these other stories where Buddhists maintain harmony with religions who are different than you, who see different than you. And there is the story of the five fingers in the hand, not the finger which is the best, but the fact that five fingers, especially this works in Indonesia, because you have the Pancasila, which doesn't mean the five Buddhist precepts, it means the five religions which are permitted in Indonesia. And so five fingers in a hand, and if one finger gets infected, you can't use the whole hand. So if one religion, say the five major religions in Indonesia, if one of those religions is suffering, you can't use the whole hand. The whole country suffers. Which is one of the reasons why. It's a beautiful simile. But all the five fingers of a hand, they're all different. But if one finger gets hurt, the other four have to look after it. And understanding that is how we can create harmony. It's in everybody's interest to have harmony. And the... This is a good one. How did you break the news to your mum that you wanted to become a monk? What was her reaction? Well, actually, my father's reaction was more interesting. When I wanted to become a monk, people often ask, what did your father say? I said, nothing. He died about 7 years early. You always have a sense of humour. Sometimes people just think it's really stupid, it's a macabre sense of humour. But anyway, I'm sure my father would have not minded that. So anyway, I was on Friday night telling all the funeral jokes about the undertaker who was found wandering in the cemetery with the coffin. He'd lost the plot. Ha 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 ha. Okay. But you know that Buddhist monks, actually usually a lot of either ex-Buddhist monks or before they became monks, they actually were undertakers. And I imagine those, especially the Vipassana meditators, are so calm and peaceful and somber, they make really good undertakers. And so I know a lot of these undertakers, and because I do many, and there's this one monk, he's a monk over in Sydney. If any of you go to Sydney and go to Budurang Si, that's over in Campbelltown, is the Venerable Harry. That was his name before. And he wrote a beautiful book of From Balmain to Buddha, because that's where he was brought up, in Balmain, really the roughest suburb of Sydney, when he was born. And he said, his opening line in his book, which I thought was a brilliant opener for his book, He said, if you still have your two front teeth by the time you're four, it means you're a girl. They were fighting there all the time. But he also told that he got a job as an undertaker. And once he was actually called to collect the body, you know, in one of these old apartment buildings in Sydney, on the top story. And because this was an apartment building, everybody knew each other, because there's only one elevator, one lift to go up and down, and only a small lift as well. So, you know, they always met one another, so they knew this gentleman in the top story had passed away. And so these two undertakers, imagine, just really somber in a black suit, you know, went up there to collect the body. This is an absolute true story, he told me. But how can you get the gurney, it's almost like a trolley, in such a small lift, such a small elevator? It just would not fit in. And it couldn't take them down the stairs. So they thought what to do. And so what they did, there was enough space, only just enough space in the elevator for three people standing. So the two funeral directors, undertakers, they were standing on either side of the edge of the lift with the dead man in between when they were holding him up, hoping that no one would interfere their journey going down to the ground floor where they could put them into the gurney and put him into the back of the van. And of course there is one Dhamma. You know, it's not just the Four Noble Truths, it's not dependent origination, it's not the law of karma. It's one which all religions agree on is fundamental to the way of this universe, and it is called Murphy's Law. You've heard of Murphy's Law? Yeah, if it can go wrong, it will go. And he told me, there he was, just holding this dead fellow. You know, he had one side, his friend had the other side in the middle of the lift. And halfway down, the lift started to decelerate. Somebody had pressed the button and they wanted to get in the elevator. Oh my goodness, what to do? And so, as the elevator doors opened, there were, yeah, exactly, it was this little old woman. And what she saw, you could see her eyes go like dinner plates. The blood drained from her face. She saw these two severe grey-looking men with this person she knew had died was right between them. And he said he doesn't know how this happened, but they'd lost hold of this fellow and the fellow started falling. yeah, that's what happened. And this poor woman, she fainted away. She passed out. It's quite understandable. And she thought, oh my gosh, so the only thing they could do was actually to pull this guy up again and go down, and they thought they'd have to go up to the third floor to get another customer. But fortunately, when they got up there, you know, she just was a bit shocked and a bit stressed, but, you know, gave her a cup of tea and she was fine again. So, again, some of those things which happen in life. And I don't want to go for this. I'm not quite sure. This is supposed to be about different religions. Okay, anyway. So anyway, but another interesting story he said, because he was from the Balmain was the port city, the port town in Sydney, so he spent a lot of his time in the merchant navy. And one of the other things which he said happened once was really weird. He said he was on watch on this merchant ship in the middle of some voyage somewhere. And they had to have the first officer, you know, with him on duty that night. And they were just talking about all sorts of things. Now, as you do, just passing the time. They had to be on watch. And then he said he saw some of the weirdest things he'd ever seen. This green light on the horizon. Never seen that before. And so the first mate and him were just talking, what on earth can this be? And as they were talking about this, he said, this is no joke. And I believe Harry, because he's a Buddhist monk, and sometimes that people, you know, do pull your leg, but this was a true case. He said, this green light immediately just came whizzing over the ocean and hovered over the boat. He said it was such a strange thing that the first mate just went to the captain's cabin to try and wake the captain, which took a while, at which time the green light disappeared. And he said that occurred in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle. He said, no, honestly, he said that was absolutely true. It was one of the weirdest things he'd ever experienced. Anyway, how did you break the news to your mum that you wanted to become a monk? Now, that's a serious, because my mother knew, you know, the direction I was heading in life. And she also knew that I'd always been a very reliable, responsible young man, never getting into trouble, getting a good degree from Cambridge. And so if it didn't go well as a Buddhist monk, if I disrobed, she knew that I could come back and get a good job. It wasn't the end of the world. I was like 23 years old when I became a monk. So, you know, you can always just disrobe and come back again. That was a wonderful thing about being a monk in the Theravada tradition, that you could disrobe any time. If you didn't like it, it wasn't for you, if you realized you made a mistake, you know, you didn't lose any status, you always gained things, a lot of wisdom from, you know, what you learned as being a Buddhist monk and some great friends. So it was always a win-win situation. Even now, and after 45 years coming up as a Buddhist monk, I can leave any time. You only stay as a monk or as a nun because you're finding it useful and beneficial. And you know, one of the worst things would be if you get a person who ordains as a monk when they're really young, and later on in life they feel they made a mistake. That's not really the journey they want to go. Because how can you really be sure when you're so young about, you know, the choices which you make? So because there's lots of freedom, you know, to do something else in your life, that's why many people stay as monks. Because you can sort of leave, you don't want to. The psychology of it. Anyway, so I told my mum, I said, well, you know, the chances are that, you know, I would probably not last as a monk. You know, who knows? I told my mother, and she was obviously happy that I was happy. And that's, you know, what many parents want. They want your children to be happy. She said the only thing she didn't like was I was going to become a monk on the other part of the world where she couldn't reach. She said, I'd have preferred if you were a monk next door. But she said, okay, you know, I won't stand in your way. And of course, you know, she had a lot of joy later on when she knew I was a monk and was very, very happy. So it was wonderful. And of course, I was telling people, because I became a monk, I had one brother, and don't ask me how many other brothers you did, how many brothers. I thought I'd get one of those questions this evening. No, people put on the question box. Ajahn Brahm, what does your mother and father do? How many brothers and sisters have you got? When I tell that story, I usually get those as questions. But anyway, when you do become a monk, it doesn't mean you abandon your family. Because there's this one monk, he's over in Canada, Ajahn Veeradhamma. And his mother got really, really sick and had no one else to look after her. So he went to look after his mother for a month or two. And his mother started to getting a little bit better, but then when he planned to leave again, she got sick again. And so he stayed looking after his mother for about, was it, 8 or 9 years? And he was his mother's carer. And he managed to keep all his rules. It was a bit of a stretch because I think his brother had an account at the local grocery shop. So that is, Ajahn V would actually go to the grocery shop and get the goods. So he never paid. It was all on the account for his brother set up. And go home and just cook the food for his mum and look after her. And he always thought that she was dying soon, you know, only another week or two to go. And that went on for years. But then afterwards, people were just so impressed that, you know, just because you become a monk, doesn't mean you don't look after your parents. And he stayed, and that was the extreme. I've never seen anything as amazing as that. Looking after his mother for such a long time. And you could do that within the rules of Vinaya. And afterwards, when his mother did pass away, you know, he took over the monastery in Canada and just did a wonderful job. I thought, just what an inspiring thing that is. You know, that he can still do all of that and be a monk at the same time. What is the benefit and danger of hypnotic regression? Can it be inaccurate? Example, our mind makes its own imagination. Thank you. It really depends upon the skill of the hypnotist. Good hypnotists never give leading questions. And, you know, they just encourage you to actually to explore. But it's really your journey. And you always see that in hypnotic regression, that usually that when you do get to very powerful experiences in life, it does come with like a huge emotion which you cannot imagine. And that emotional discharge, if you like, is a sign that what you're experiencing actually happened. And of course, there's much evidence now you can go back and find out for yourself. You go back to the records and it's there. I do imagine I was born poor and often I felt sad to see how depressed my mum is when she's struggling financially. Now I'm not poor anymore, but I still have insecurity and attachment to money. How to deal with this? Thank you. There's advantages and disadvantages of being poor. And one of the advantages is, you know, you can live simply. You don't need so much to live a happy, peaceful life. So first of all, just think how much you need. And you go to a temple or a monastery, and sometimes you can live so simply, and you think, well, why do I feel insecure? I don't need very much. I've learnt from my experience of growing up and also my experience of just going to retreat centers or monastery, how little you need to live happily. And of course, the biggest security or insurance you can ever get is your family and friends. Because they'll always be there for you whenever there's any difficulty in your life. So it doesn't mean be your blood relationships. You know, all the family in your community who've looked after you and you've looked after them, they're the ones you rely on in times of difficulty. And it's not the money. So as long as you're maybe poor in money, but as long as you have a very good social network, a very good sort of person, always kind and helping others, then of course, that law of karma will mean you never need to feel insecure. There's always many people look after you. As for me, I don't take insurance when I go off overseas. I don't need insurance. Because if I go to different countries, even to go to, say, Thailand, there's always monks' hospitals. But I wouldn't need that. If I fell over and broke a leg in Thailand, people would be so overjoyed they could make some good karma looking after me. Same in Hong Kong. Imagine if I got sick in Hong Kong. How many doctors? No, me, please, I'll look after you. No, you looked after him last time, my turn. So, you know, a lot of time the kindness you've given others actually comes back to you in times of adversity. You know what real health insurance is. Do you think when people strictly keeping the precepts, they cannot be free? As long as they keep the two precepts, then they can be as free as anything. Never harming themselves, never harming another. But sometimes, you know, the so-called strictly keeping precepts, the precepts make you relaxed. To the point that these days, as a monk, so what do I want to break any precepts for? Makes no sense to me. Keeping precepts, keeping restraint, is freedom. So I always say, tell people, if you want to live a good life, be a good person. I am a good person, I think. So I have a good time. I'm a good time monk. Is it dangerous by being Hopi since it can lead to high expectations that brings disappointment? No, it doesn't mean expectations. Hoping means anything can happen. So you hope for the best, prepare for the worst. And disappointment? Nah. If it's disappointed, it doesn't go your way, things don't go wrong. What is it? More dog poo for my long entry. So either way, you win. So what's the alternative? You're being hopey, then you get disappointment. Of course, disappointments are parts of life, but also successes. Happiness is also part of life. So the more hopey you are, the more the odds are of happiness, peace and freedom. Imagine, I said, you know, you've been meditating here for how many days? And you haven't got jhanas or peace yet? You're a waste of time. You're hopeless. Imagine I said that. Then that would actually put a big barrier between you and any possibility of deep meditation. But you'd be hopey. When you're hopey, of course, eventually it happens. You're taking away the barrier, which many people have these days, of thinking, I can't do this. Yes, you can. As Mr. Obama famously said. He was a Buddhist, I'm sure. Yes, you can. How to respond to a judgmental husband is actually don't argue with him, agree with him. That totally undermines the pleasure he gets from being judgmental. Or what did I say the other day? A judgmental husband. Tell him. But Ajahn Brahm said, the advice of a master to his student, never argue with an idiot. Do you agree with that? Yes. Are you calling me an idiot? Now, sometimes people are judgmental, but you just say, yes, dear, yes, dear, yes, dear. Because what that does, why are they being judgmental? And why does people discriminate and say, oh, you're like this, you're like that? And sometimes you say, yes, dear, because it's not, how can you judge anybody? It's nothing to do with you. It's just a person feels that they're, a lot of time in a relationship, it's because they're really upset. There's no happiness, things are going wrong in their day. And they usually try and take it out on people they love. Why? Because they think, you know, you've been married together for such a long time, that you should realize, your husband is not being critical of you. He's just being critical, he had a very busy day. Or difficulty in the business, or difficulty in the family. That's why it takes it out on you. So, if you're a wife or a husband, when your partner says rotten things and judgmental things about you, remember the story of the man who had the afternoon off work and went to buy the eggs from the market. Remember that story? Some nodding their head, some are already asleep. this particular husband had the afternoon off work. Wife said, darling, I need some eggs for the dinner tonight. So off he went, getting the eggs. Never been to the market before. Wife had to give him instructions and money and everything. Off he went with the basket to get some eggs. And as soon as he came into the market, this young man came up to him, almost nose to nose, and said, you are the ugliest person I've ever seen in my whole life. You are just so awful the way you look at your face looks. You've got a face like a back of a camel. And as for your smell, you're saying, when was the last time you washed? You smell like dog shit. Obviously, you're a terrible person. And much worse things than that, this young man said. And this husband never seen this guy in his life before. And he's being criticized and scolded and abused in public, in front of everybody, in the marketplace. This was too much. And so the husband turned around and went home really upset. And he went home and slammed the door, and his wife said, "You come back home early." "Yeah, I never want to go to that stupid market ever again. It's a terrible place. People are just so uncivilized and uncouth. It's a terrible place. I don't know how you handle it. It's a rotten place. I never want to go there ever again. It's a bad place. It's terrible." I remember doing that in Indonesia. And I got poor, remember Tasfan? Yeah, I got Tasfan. "Translate, please." Oh, sometimes I tease my translators. But anyway, so the wife calmed him down and said, "Oh, it's him. That young man, when he was a boy, he fell over and he hit his head. He's got brain damage. That poor young man will never ever go to school and get any degree or something. He'll never get a job. That poor young man will probably never find a nice girl to share his life with. He just hangs around the market. He abuses me much worse than that. He abuses everybody. That's just, he's crazy, he's brain damaged." So as soon as the husband realized he'd been shouted at and abused and cursed by someone who wasn't in the right mind, all his anger vanished. And so he just, his wife saw that and said, "Darling, I still need those eggs." And said, "Okay, darling." And so off he went, back into the market. And then this boy came up to him again and said, scolded him, "Here comes camel face. Here comes dog poo. Here comes all that." And he was going, this time it didn't matter at all. Because how can you worry about being criticized or judged by somebody who wasn't in the right mind? And he managed to buy those eggs, talk with the lady selling the eggs, and "Oh, poor young man, yeah, he fell over and he hit his head. What a sad thing that was." And the moral of that story is, if your husband comes home from work and he judges you and scolds you and gets angry at you, just assume he must have hit his head that day at work. Because anger is called temporary insanity. So you are mad to get angry at anybody. So that's the assumption. And then it's going, "Oh, darling, you've hit your head again today." Anyway, it's only to discuss mental husbands. Why old monks will die due to illness if deep meditation is good to our health? Oh, yeah, I know, but come on, give monks a break. They've got an old body. You know, if they are going to get reborn again, they get a much healthier body. You know, as I always said, look, if you've got an old, say, freezer in your house, which takes a lot to maintain, how many people would keep an old freezer when they can just go off and recycle it and get a new modern one? You've got an old computer, you know, just one of those old computers, you know, from the 1990s or 2000. Would you like to keep that? No, just recycle it and get a new modern one, a small one, on your iPhones or something. They're much more powerful. I remember at Cambridge, they just put in this multi-million dollar new number cruncher in the mathematics department. They had to build a new building for it. And now, just this little iPhone, so you can much, much more powerful computing power than these old huge things. So who wants to keep this old thing going? That's why. Who wants to keep an old monk going? Wouldn't it be better to get a new, improved model monk? Trade in the old one. So, monks will die due to illness in deep meditation. Of course it's good to your health. So you die peacefully. Instead of moaning and groaning. So you say, "Oh, I've got a sickness. I'm going to die." The doctor says to you, "You're going to die in a week." And the monk looks to the doctor and says, "Can you make it tomorrow, please?" Not extend life, bring it on. Or just like reality, this Dr. K.C. Dhammananda, when he had cancer And when he was told by his doctors, nothing more they can do, his cancer is terminal, he's going to die, he burst out laughing. And I remember the doctor, I checked with the doctor, because I go to Malaysia a lot, and he says, yeah, that happened, he's the only person I ever know. When he died, or just before he died, and the doctor said, there's nothing more they can do, he's going to die soon, he burst out laughing. That's a monk's monk. Can you do that? The doctor says you're going to die. Say you're going to die in a week. What would your reaction be? Would you say, like that one person said when he was told he was going to die in a week? And he said, doctor, I don't think I can pay your bills in 1 week. Okay, I'll give you 2 weeks then. Or the other person who went to see the doctor, and he says, I said, how long have I got? And the doctor says, 10. And I said, 10 what? 10 weeks? 10 days? And the doctor says, 9, 8, 7, 6. That's terminal. So, the last question. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for your love and inspiration. You're a mega meta inspiration. Love you. Thank you very much. So that's the last question. So now is the time for a toilet break. And then you come back and we do the loving kindness, guided meditation. So it's actually 5 to 4 now, so please come back by 10 past. Okay, is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. So there's many toilets to go to. So if you're really desperate, the close ones are just round the corner. So already, they already got a leader who's going to get to the ladies' toilets first. There's many others, so off you go. The race is on. On your marks, get set, go! Okay. Oops. Okay, and in the meantime, I don't get to go to the toilet. I just sign books.